Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate agreed to begin debating the Immigration Reform Bill. Its name is the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act. The bill provides a path to citizenship, which would allow immigrants to stay in the country after they pay a fine, fees, and back taxes. It would also result in stronger border enforcement. And if Republican senators get their way, the route to legal citizenship would not be possible until the government can monitor and control, quote, every segment of the southern border. The topic that hasn't been mentioned in this debate is detention. In the United States, nearly 34,000 migrants are being held in over 250 immigration detention centers across the country, from county jails to massive private centers. They might be asylum seekers, undocumented migrants, or green card residents with a past conviction. Those in custody include men, women, children, and sometimes entire families. Detainees are being held in prison-like conditions, and immigrants do not have the right to an attorney, even if they have a strong case, so they have to represent themselves in court. Over the past 5 years, the number of immigrants being held and the costs of detaining them have doubled. In 2012, the Obama administration's budget for immigration enforcement was almost $2 billion. Detention centers cost an average of $164 per bed per day. So what are the conditions in these facilities? Who's running them? And what explains the growth of immigration detention centers across the United States? Today, we're joined by Catalina Nieto. She's field director with the Detention Watch Network. Detention Watch is the only national network that focuses exclusively on working to expose and challenge the conditions in the detention and deportation system. And Catalina joins us from Atlanta. Hi, Catalina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's nice to have you. We're also joined by Ravi Ragbir, an organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City, an interfaith network of organized communities resisting deportation. In addition to being an immigration rights activist, husband, and father, Ravi is also an immigrant at risk of facing deportation. And Ravi joins us from New York. Hi, Ravi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
It's nice to have you. We did invite ICE to join us, but they were unable to join. We do have a statement from them about a variety of issues, and I'll read those throughout the show. So first of all, the immigration debate obviously has been on fire for the last couple of years, but the Senate just agreed to formally begin debating. And Ravi, what explains the absence of detention centers? Have they even been mentioned at all in this debate?
They haven't been mentioned in this debate because it's the focus is the pathway, the legalization of over 11 million people, and the enforcement of borders, the southern borders. And although we look and focus on the southern borders, and Catalina can speak to this also, it is about the northern border going to be picked up in this round of immigration reform. And you don't hear about detention because we expect that it will continue to be what it is, because they're not removing any of the reasons people are going to be detained. All they're doing is giving us legalization and the continued reasons why people are detained, over 34,000 immigrants that is detained daily, will still be there. So even after the reform, so-called reform, we expect that those numbers to be maintained in immigration by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And no one wants to touch it because it is such a, if you really hear the facts about what is happening, it will derail the whole process. And everyone is just wants the process to continue, except a few groups like Catalina, like Detention Watch and New Sanctuary and a few other groups that is outspoken against any form of detention and any form of deportation.
And Catalina, how do you explain the lack of attention on these detention centers? I mean, they're so massive, so many people are in them. Why isn't anyone talking about them?
Well, I mean, this is a very complex system, obviously. There's, as you mentioned before, there's about 250 detention centers. Some of them are private detention centers, about 50% are private. The others are contracts that ICE makes with jails and county jails. I mean, with the immigration reform, we know that any drastic reform to immigration laws need to dramatically, if not stop altogether, you know, detention and deportation. What's complicated about the immigration reform right now is that a lot of people are going to be left out of a path to citizenship. You know, anyone who has a criminal conviction on their record is automatically going to be left out, and that's going to be justification for more criminalization, more detention, and more deportation. And then we also looked at, you know, some of the history of some of the laws and policies that have been put in place that are criminalizing our communities and pretty much charging them with those, you know, felonies or misdemeanors. We hear, for example, our Sheriff Arpaio, that's what he does. He charges people with felonies so that there is a reason to lock them up, keep them detained, and then deport them. So, I mean, this is just one small aspect of what's happening, you know, across the board, something that's very systematic, right? And we are concerned, you know, that obviously a bill needs to include that, needs to make sure that deportation stops, that detention stops. If we're concerned about family unity and, you know, keeping families together, that's the place to look at, stopping the detention and deportation.
Well, so this is obviously getting a lot of media attention, and so much of the focus is on the Republican sticking point about border security. A lot of people say it's militarizing the border. They're talking about drones, basically saying that legal citizenship will not be possible until the government can monitor and control, quote, every segment of the southern border. So, Ravi, how will this debate affect the people, 34,000 people that are currently being held in these detention centers?
How will it affect the 34,000 people in detention? You have to know that it's still going to be 34,000 beds that is appropriate, that is budgeted by the Congress, so that ICE will budgeted by Congress. And one of the things about this particular appropriation is it is not if they have people to place in those detention centers. They are saying the Congress is saying that they have to fill the bed space. It's not approximate. It's not maybe you only picked up one person and so there's 400 beds empty. No, they're saying that they have, the Republicans and those hawks are saying that they have to fill the bed space, and that's part of the problem. If you insist and you ensure or you force the agency to fill 34,000 beds, how can you not impact or go off? How can you not destroy the communities that that they will be looking at? So how will it affect the people in detention? They will still have 34,000 people in detention. They will still have over 400,000 people being deported. And you remember that a lot of those in detention, those 34,000, it's a constant move. They don't, average time they spend in detention, according to the Supreme Court, is anywhere 5 months to process their case. So you're looking at a constant flow of immigrants in that space. And one thing when you introduced me, you didn't introduce me as someone who has actually faced detention. I spent 2 years in detention. I've seen the flow of migrants. I've seen the flow of people picked up just riding a bicycle. I've seen the flow of people going home. I've seen that flow where they were just taken by immigration. I was taken to Alabama in detention centers down in Alabama, and they were taking these people out from Tennessee and not giving them a chance to call their families. They were moving them from Tennessee through Alabama to Louisiana to be deported. Would that change? We expect not, because again, the policy will not really have changed for when it deals with the enforcement, when it deals with the detention, and when it deals with deportation. So you will still have massive amount of deportation, even with the so-called reform, because it is not a true reform. It is just you may have someone getting a work permit, but you have 10 years. You have at least 10 years before you can be fully become a permanent resident. Within that time, if there is any interaction or if there is any question about what you're doing, interaction with law enforcement, that puts you at jeopardy. And we have seen our families, our communities being jeopardized. I'm in New York City. We have stop and frisk. If you go to any other communities, you have over 84,000 people being stop and frisk, mostly of black and brown communities, some of which, if with the programs that the immigration has, ESCOM, and I'm throwing out a lot of terms here, and I'm sorry, but you know, any that interaction, when that fingerprint goes up, what happens? If you're undocumented or you there is question about what you're doing or why you're doing it, or because you're suspected because of your color of your skin, and you're placed in prison, or you're placed in the system, that endangers you and endangers your family and endangers your life, because there is no forgiveness in the system, and the system is criminalizing our communities. I'll stop because I can continue talking, but I'll stop and let Catalina interrupt.
That is Ravi Ragbir, an organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City. He came to the U.S. from Trinidad in 1991 on a visitor's visa. In 94, he became a lawful permanent resident with a green card holder. His daughter was born the next year. And then based on a single conviction for fraud, he was detained and ordered deported in 2006 by an immigration judge without a hearing on his family ties and subject to mandatory indefinite detention in New Jersey and Alabama, far from his community and his young daughter. And this is just one of many stories. Today we are talking about immigration detention centers. The immigration debate is going to formally begin, yet as Ravi and Catalina said, the topic of detention centers has not been raised at all. 34,000 immigrants are being held in over 250 immigration detention centers across the country. 50% are private. And we're also joined by Catalina Nieto, field director with the Detention Watch Network. What explains the growth? What are your thoughts on this? We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this topic that really doesn't get that much attention? And the numbers are on the rise. What explains this? And if you work for an organization that is closely connected to immigrants, if you're an immigrant, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in law enforcement, we'd love to hear from you. Again, we did invite ICE to join us, and they were unable to, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. or leave a comment on our website. So as Ravi said, ICE has to fill 34,000 beds every day. ICE also, according to reports, advocates and lawyers, they need to hit a targeted number of deportations every year, and that's 400,000. Well, last year, 409,000 people were deported. And I want to play a clip on this. This is from the Frontline documentary that aired 2 years ago called Lost in Detention. And it was hosted by Marina Hinojosa. And you'll hear her voice along with Michael Rozos. He is a former field office director of ICE. And here's that clip.
This aggressive enforcement by ICE has been driven, according to insiders, by the agency's need to hit a target number of deportations, now 400,000 a year.
Because the number 400,000 was what was agreed upon, what's happened is you pick up whatever you can. So the low-hanging fruit, the high-hanging fruit, and all the fruit that's in between, you would pick up whatever you could and take your collateral apprehensions, which would be the other illegals that may be present when you're arresting the fugitive, and bring them into custody as well to get the numbers moved up.
The pressure to move the numbers up was evident in an internal ICE memo last year. ICE was at risk of falling well under the agency's goal of 400,000 deportations, the memo says. In particular, it highlighted the shortfall of non-criminal removals.
So basically, Washington is setting some numbers, and on the ground, if you're not meeting those numbers, then you're being judged by not meeting those numbers.
You're being judged or you're being summoned to Washington. You know, you'll get this, be in my office tomorrow morning, so kind of a thing.
And that is a clip from the Frontline documentary Lost in Detention. You heard Michael Rozos, former field office director of ICE, talking about this targeted number of deportations. And Catalina, where did these numbers come from? Who came up with this 400,000 number?
So there's different things at play, you know, and there's obviously like a long history. On one side, you know, in 1996, there were laws that passed, mandatory detention laws. That's when the system within immigration changed in terms of anyone who was ordered deportation was pretty much mandated to be detained. So on one side, you know, we have lots of people that have an immigration case that could very easily be, you know, reporting to court or whatever they need to do, still staying with their families and their communities. But these laws made them have to be detained and while they're going through the process. And then it also, you know, expanded the definition of aggravated felony, so more people could be charged with, you know, these in quote-unquote crimes, and then be mandated to be locked up, pretty much. But then we have the number, it's basically a quota that Congress is giving ICE of how many people need to be in detention every day. So Congress appropriates a certain amount of money, and they tell ICE that they have to use that money to keep 34,000 beds filled every day. We just heard, actually, from the House Appropriation Committee that they have approved $147 million more dollars to go this year into detention and deportation as well. So on top of the $2 billion. And then, you know, I think the other piece of this is the profit, right? Mm-hmm. The profit that's being made off of these. We have, you know, private prison industries like Correction Corporation of America and the GEO Group. They are making a lot of money off of having people detained. And they have very powerful lobby group putting a lot of money also into this kind of legislation. You know, all these anti-immigrant bills like 287G, like Arizona-style bills, secure communities, they've been drafted, you know, with the help of some of these lobby groups because it serves them. It gives profits to them to criminalize people and channel them into detention centers.
And what about the 34,000 number? ICE has to fill 34,000 beds every day. When did that come about? Who's behind making these decisions, coming up with these numbers?
It's basically, they're saying it's how much Congress appropriates. It comes from the appropriations process. And they say that they appropriate a certain amount of money to fill the 34,000 beds. I think, you know, it's like a quota that they have just on the top of their head almost, you know. But I do think, you know, the connection with profit is very important because if you mandate, you know, ICE to fill 34,000 beds, that means that, you know, we have about some of these detention centers charge as much as $160 per day per person, you know. So imagine if you have a quota of 34,000 beds filled every day, the profit that's going to generate, not only for prison, you know, corporations, but also county jails, they're also kind of almost starting to depend on that, For their budget.
And I want to ask you about ICE, because, again, we invited ICE and they were unable to join us. I asked Virginia Kais with a Western Regional Communications Director, that's her title, about the 400,000 number. And she wrote me and said, if you're referring to a USA Today article that ran earlier this year, my colleague, ICE Public Affairs colleague Jillian Christensen, was quoted saying that, quote, ICE does not have quotas. And here's her statement. USA Today's story lacks context and does not present an accurate picture of ICE's focus on criminal offenders. Consistent with the administration's policy and following directions from ICE HQ to field offices around the country to continue to focus operations on level one and level two criminal offenders or those convicted of a felony or multiple misdemeanors. Over the last 4 years, this administration has fundamentally changed immigration enforcement policy. ICE is focused on smart, effective enforcement that prioritizes the removal of criminal aliens, recent border crossers, and egregious immigration law violators, such as those who have been previously removed from the U.S., and ICE's 2012 year-end removal numbers highlight this focus. What's your comment on that statement, Ravi?
They say they don't have a quota, but you just heard from on that frontline piece that they have been summoned to Congress if they don't meet certain figures. So that statement obviously contradicts what they are saying on other reports, and we have seen it. You know, we have seen that the Sessions, Senator Sessions, or other like-minded electors will call Jonathan, Secretary of Homeland Security Jonathan Politano, and why are they not meeting their figures? Why are they not deporting if they haven't met that those figures? Why they haven't met those figures? And so it belies the fact that they're just trying to they know it's a horrendous number. They know to place in detention 34,000 people daily for just being who they are, not doing anything else. It will cause massive amounts of protests and voices against them. One of the things that they talk about criminal aliens, and they talk about the level one and level two. Immigration is a civil proceeding, meaning that it has nothing to do with criminal justice. It is basically a political statement, a political decision by the country. It is civil, and even if someone has a criminal conviction, I have a criminal conviction, and you just read earlier, I serve my time. I have fulfilled my obligation to that conviction, and yet now the criminal justice who has deemed me rehabilitated, and since 2006 I have apart from the 2 years I spent in detention, I have worked in the community. I have had lots of interaction with people. I've been to Congress to testify. I have been, my wife and my daughter, U.S. citizens. My community loves me. Why am I still being penalized? Why is anyone being penalized by a system that is not prison-like in condition? It is prison. I have been there. It is prison.
And Ravi, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll talk about the fact after the break that immigration law, unlike criminal law, immigrants do not get a right to counsel. They actually have to represent themselves in court. We're talking about detention centers on Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard expressed yet in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Special thanks here at KALW to Catherine Greeno of Pittsburgh and Deborah Gage of San Jose for their continued support of Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the Obama administration's record on civil liberties. We'll explore the impacts of the National Security Agency's data collection system and then revelations about technology companies sharing personal information. But before these programs were exposed, civil liberties advocates called the president's record, quote, dismal on civil liberties. So we'll talk about why that is. That's tomorrow. And then Friday, we'll discuss media attention or media coverage. It's gotten a lot of attention, that's for sure. Media coverage of the NSA's program. If anything stood out for you, Glenn Greenwald has been all over the place for his reporting in The Guardian. We'd love to hear about it. You can email a link or information, comments to feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about immigration detention centers. 34,000 immigrants are held in over 250 centers across the country. About half are private. The Senate just voted to begin debating the immigration reform bill, but the issue of detention centers has not been mentioned. It's costing $2 billion a year. People are being swept up for things like minor traffic offenses, sometimes sent hours away from their families. Their families search high and low for them. They have no idea where they are. And then the person being held is not really told what's going to happen to them. And they do not have the right to counsel. And so they often have to represent themselves in court. So we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this? What explains the rise in these centers? If you work with the immigration population, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with law enforcement, we'd love to hear from you. We did invite ICE to join us and they weren't available. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Catalina Nieto, field director with the Detention Watch Network. Ravi Ragbir is an organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City, and he spent 2 years in detention. And let's hear from Andrew in San Francisco. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I first want to say I'm very sympathetic to everything that your guests have been are bringing up. I myself am first-generation American, so, you know, I think everyone should have the opportunity that the United States provides. On the other hand, I can't help but feel like what's being talked about is kind of a wag the dog scenario. In other words, you've committed a crime or you've broken the law, and it is against the law to come into the United States illegally, and then you're detained, and then you're complaining about the detention, and then all the other subsequent things that come along with it, and like you bring your family along with you, putting them at great risk, and that's only compounded over time when you put down roots in a country or put down roots anywhere, and then you're uprooted. So I guess I would ask your guests, why is it that crossing the border gives anyone the right to become U.S. citizens or to be in this country as opposed to other people who actually follow the rules? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks. All right. Thanks, Andrew. We'll get your question in a minute. I just want to take our next caller because he can't stay long. Let's go to Grant in Santa Cruz. Hi, Grant.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this show. And I guess I'm an immigrant, and I wanted to say that it upsets me that this government does not, with entities that have such huge budgets, that it seems so often to not be willing to dialogue about what these departments are doing. And I think, you know, whether it's ICE or the Immigration and Naturalization Service, I found through my experience of going through applying to become a citizen that there were a number of instances where the people involved were very cavalier in their behavior, and I was in a very vulnerable position as a non-citizen applying for citizenship, and I felt that there was abuse in that system, and I think there is in many different ways. And I think whether it's the detention centers or in other aspects, that it can be an abusive system, and there's often not ways in which people can address that who are within the system. And I feel that's a very undemocratic branch of our government, and I
Well, and hold on just a minute, because, Grant, that is really an important issue, and we'll talk about that. But I'm just wondering, would you respond to Andrew, who said, people who cross the border, why should they have the right to become a U.S. citizen? What would you say to Andrew?
Well, I think we all have some basic human rights, and I think, I think almost all of us come from immigrant histories. I mean, Native Americans, I think, are about the only people that are indeed citizens of this land and are grounded deeply in this land. I think the rest of us in past generations have come here, and some of us are still coming here. And I think I think there is a pattern in this society of people drawing the line behind them of saying, well, no, I'm a citizen, you're not a citizen, or you're after me, you're further back in the line, and
All right, well, thank you so much for addressing that, and we will definitely talk about abuses, because this Frontline documentary exposed numerous racial, sexual abuses, so many different things. But before we get to that, Catalina, or actually Ravi, why don't you first address Andrew's question, because you're an immigrant who spent 2 years in detention.
Right. There are a number of things that Andrew mentioned. He talked about you break the law. He talked about the rules. He talked about all those who follow those rules. What rules? What can someone who's facing conditions like those in Mexico, Honduras, or Africa, what rules are available to them for them to come to the United States? That's part of the problem. There is no available forms of, there are no options available to them if they want to migrate. And some of them, why are they migrating? It's not because they want to. It's because they have to, because of war, because of economic problems, it's because of environmental problems. People have to live, people have to eat, people need to take care of their kids. And I'm sure if Andrew has kids, he will understand when you hear the cries of your child in hunger, you will do anything to feed your child, and you will move and migrate to that to create that. But in itself, the United States Supreme Court, recently in 2012 said it is not a crime to be in the United States without documents. It is on the page 3 of their opinion when they wrote the opinion on SB 1070, the Arizona law. It is not a crime to be in the United States without a document. It is a trespass to cross the border, but once you're inside the United States, it is not a crime. And even if you have trespass, how can you justify putting a child? Have you ever seen children in prison because they're just immigrants? That in itself is it's a punishment. And does it justify putting someone in that system, in those conditions, because they're immigrants? Andrew was fortunate, very fortunate, that he was able to become a first American because of his parents' fortune. If Andrew was in other shoes like ours and anyone else, the millions of people who have no documents, he would be saying something else. I have a father right now who is in deportation proceedings, and he came to this country in 1958. When would you say a person is an American? What do they have to do? What do they have to prove? Is it because of a piece of paper, a piece of card that says you're an American? Or is it because of your ties or because of your relationship? Is it because of all the benefits? And immigrants is very beneficial to the community, to the country. We have seen, I just read something from Wisconsin that says that, and we noticed that the immigrants are more than twice as likely to start a business, which means it creates economic movement and creates benefits to that community that they are the part of.
And I just want to jump in, Ravi, because we did a show with Juan Gonzalez, who's out with a documentary called Harvest of Empire, also a book, just looking at why so many people come to the United States. And he focused his film on U.S. foreign policy. And we actually have a caller who wants to address that. Let's go to Antonio in San Leandro. Hi, Antonio. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Yes, I think the basic principle that the so-called advocates for the amnesty or illegal or undocumented is that because the United States is invading other countries with their corporations and armies, they have the right to come here to scab on U.S. workers. And as the U.S. workers were the ones responsible for the policy of the U.S. corporations, and destroying the unions, destroying the safety rules, destroying all what the workers gain in this country by offering a cheaper labor. That's what their contention is, and that's really despicable.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Antonio. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We are talking about detention facilities in the United States. There are 250 immigration detention centers. 34,000 immigrants are being held, costing $2 billion a day. It's about $164 per bed. And ICE is required to fill these beds every day. Half are private, and then a few of them, many are run by county jails. And the Senate just agreed to begin debating the bill yesterday, but this topic has not been mentioned. So why is this growing? What questions do you have about immigration detention centers? If you work with the immigration community, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with law enforcement, we invited ICE, but they weren't available. We're joined by Catalina Nieto, field director with the Detention Watch Network, and Ravi Ragbir is an organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City. He came to the U.S. from Trinidad in 91 on a visitor's visa. In 94, he became a lawful permanent resident with a green card. His daughter was born the next year. Based on a single conviction for fraud, he was detained and ordered deported in 2006, and he spent 2 years in detention. And again, we'd love to hear from you on this issue, 866-798-8255. And Andrew, or Grant, actually, was talking about accountability with the administration. And I want to play another clip from the Frontline documentary that aired a couple of years ago about this very issue. And in this clip, you will hear the host, Marina Hinojosa, along with Cecilia Munoz. She is President Obama's top advisor on immigration.
Even the supporters of the president, the Illinois governor, have said secure communities is doing more damage. And in fact, there's collateral damage of mothers being separated from their children, of fathers being separated from their children.
Right.
Is this collateral damage that this administration is prepared to accept?
Well, as a result of the concerns raised by the governor of Illinois, the governor of Massachusetts, and others, DHS made adjustments in how it's implementing the policy. So the feedback from the community has been important in shaping DHS's work. But at the end of the day, when you have a community of 10 million, 11 million people living and working in the United States illegally, some of these things are going to happen, even if the law is executed with perfection. There will be parents separated from their children. We don't have to like it, but it is a result of having a broken system of laws. And the answer to that problem is reforming the law.
And that is a clip from the Frontline documentary Lost in Detention. That's Cecilia Munoz, President Obama's top advisor on immigration. So what do you think about that, Catalina? Cecilia said the answer is reform. Well, Congress is talking about reform, but you're saying that these people won't be really affected. Will the 34,000 number still be on the books if this immigration law passes?
Yeah, that number. I mean, in the bill as it stands right now, there is nothing that says that, you know, this number would be eliminated. Mandatory detentions will still be in place. As I mentioned before, what's going to happen with most of the people that are not going to be able to enter into a path to citizenship? They're probably going to be channeled through the detention and deportation system. But I think, I mean, connecting a little bit the dots with what was being said before, you know, I think it's really important to understand that what's happening within the immigration system, it's not happening in a vacuum, right? It's part of a much larger system, and I think even the question of citizenship is important to consider, you know, that it's obviously important for us to get citizenship because, you know, a lot of attacks towards our community are being justified under this idea that we don't have citizenship. But we also need to understand that we live in a country where people that are citizens, that have been here, you know, that are born here, are also treated as second-class citizens. You know, we are in a country that has more people incarcerated than any other country in the world. 2.2 million people are incarcerated here. And, you know, there's a constant attack towards especially poor people of color, you know. So I think it's important to see that this is part of something much larger that needs to come into the conversation, you know. And I mean, I personally, I'm an immigrant. I came here 13 years ago. I'm also undocumented. I can tell you it was not my choice to be like that. But, you know, there's a series of very unjust laws in this country. And even if it's on the law, in the books, you know, we know historically that there's been very unjust and inhumane laws in this country as well, that they've been, you know, abolished or changed. You know, like slavery was legal at some point. What tells us that what we have right now, it's not something comparable to that? And when I look at what's happening, you know, the total lack of humanity and dignity that is within this system, you know, for me it's very comparable to some of that historical laws that have, you know, changed.
Well, speaking of the conditions, in the Frontline documentary, they uncovered many stories of racial and sexual abuse. And a lot of women talked about guards harassing them and doing just a number of things to them. And female guards said, well, don't complain because there will be retribution. So they really couldn't do anything about it. And then last month, the Arizona Central newspaper has a story called "It's Surprising That More Immigrants Do Not Commit Suicide in Jail." And they reported on two men, Elsa Guadalupe Gonzalez and Jorge Garcia Mejia. They were detained at Arizona's Eloy Detention Center, run by the Corrections Corporation of America, and were in legal proceedings relating to their right to stay lawfully in the U.S. Both were from Guatemala and approaching their 40th day in detention, and they both committed suicide. Catalina, how common is this? I mean, it's the headline itself. It's surprising that more immigrants don't commit suicide in jail.
Yeah. We, Detention Watch Network, did a report called Expose and Close, where we highlighted 10 of the worst immigrant detention centers in the country. But, I mean, this was to really show across the board. This represents 10, but it's really something that's across the board around all immigration centers in the nation. You know, we hear time and time again, like thousands and thousands of testimonies of these type of conditions, you know, physical and sexual assault. There's no, you know, system that's assuring basic medical care, adequate nutrition, exercise, even outside access. Like, we went to the Etowah Detention Center, and they don't have access to sunlight at all. Never. They're not allowed to go outside. They have to be inside a detention center indefinitely without, you know, sunlight. There's no, you know, very little access to legal services and, you know, and even worse, family visits. You know, sometimes families drive for, you know, hours to visit their family members, and they have to visit through a screen, through a telephone, not even in person. And the abuse is just, you know, I just don't understand how we can justify something like this happening, you know.
Well, we have a few more callers on the line, and we've got about 6 minutes. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, I'm so glad that you have this program, and thank you for bringing these guests there. My mother was an immigrant, and many times when people would tell her, you know, why don't you go, if you don't like it here, why don't you go back to your country, she would basically give them a very big history lesson. It seems like Americans in general, the ones who pose that position of about calling people illegal, have no idea about the whole foreign policy issues, about the level of intervention in Latin America in particular, and in Mexico, by the U.S. corporations. And it seems to me that when people get outraged about the internment of the Japanese because they were American citizens, I find that to be also very, very disgusting, because there is no reason to intern anybody or for any reason if they have not committed any crime. And as somebody stated previously, it is not illegal to be in a country. It's illegal to trespass, but not to be. And I think that we have to start thinking as American citizens that we cannot adopt this position of, oh, they did that to American citizens. That's horrible. That they should not do that to anybody in general. And in this case, the undocumented deserve the same level of respect and dignity as anyone else.
All right. Well,
and I'm very glad that your guest mentioned about how people are incarcerated and treated in this country who are American citizens, because it's true. It's basically a business. Mm-hmm. Keeping people locked up is a business in this country.
Well,
we have people doing slave labor, doing Victoria's Secret underwears and military boots for $2 a day.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I've read about that one. Well, the Corrections Corporation of America has spent $18 million from 1999 to 2009, averaging about $3 million a year. Catalina, you mentioned lobbying earlier. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? And who does this money go to? I mean, what politicians give an open door to some, you know, a corporation like the Corrections Corporation of America, which runs these private prisons?
Yeah. So, I mean, these private prisons have different lobby groups, and there's actually an organization that we work closely with. They're called Enlace, and they're doing a lot of work tracking some of this information. They've tracked, you know, what lobby groups are lobbying for certain types of bills, but also, you know, the contributions from these groups towards campaign contributions. And I mean, we could say that probably in almost every single state there's been contributions by some of these corporations to senators, to House representatives, whether small or large.
All right. Well, thank you for that information. Thanks for calling in, Lisa. Let's go to our next caller, Mohammed in San Francisco. Hi, Mohammed. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
Good. My question actually, it's about we bring in people from overseas each year, doctor, engineer. We're hoping they work over here as doctor or engineer, but no one of them work in that service. Most of them, they work in the fast food restaurant or taxis. And I hope if the government do amnesty for those people be living here illegally, even people they're in detention, because they already speak English, they acclimate with society, they've been here for years and years. And this is my question, why we bring in people overseas instead of giving people paper here.
Okay, well, thank you. Actually, Holly Kernan hosted a show somewhat similar to that about H-1B visas in Silicon Valley last Wednesday, so be sure to check out that show. Thank you for calling, Mohammed. We'll take one more caller just quickly, and then we'll get final thoughts. Caitlin in San Francisco. Hi, Caitlin.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Basically, I'm seeing that these places are Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, sorry. That these places are really just holding pens to deport people. My question, why don't they just deport them right away instead of holding them? And number two, how long can they be held? Mm. And number three, is there any other reason that they're in there that we don't know about?
All right. Ravi, do you want to take that quickly? We're almost out of time.
Sure. Before I do that, I'd like to, you talked about lobbying. When I was in detention, the cost of feeding me for one day, for one whole day, was 75 cents. And they have been paid over $160. They make a lot of profit. And so that, you know, our Senator here, Schumer, has accepted money from lobbying groups.
Charles Schumer?
Charles Schumer mm-hmm. has accepted money from lobbying groups. And that's why you don't hear anything about detention. To address the questions that the person threw out, I know she's thinking humanely, why wouldn't you just deport a person? Well, the person doesn't want to be deported, so they want to fight, and they want to have a due process because they want to be given that opportunity to present their case. And they don't have, the court does not have discretion to allow anyone to stay here unless they fit into certain rules. And under the rule that Catalina spoke about in 1996, the 96 laws, there is mandatory detention as you go through the process. And that's the inhumanity of it. So the caller should not ask the question, why don't you deport the person? Why do you have to put them in detention, even if they are in proceedings? And no, there is no one else. If they are in proceedings, that's the reason they're there, because they are being deported. And you can hold someone indefinitely. I met someone who was coming here from an African country facing death and possible death, and he was taken into detention immediately. He spent 10 years, claiming asylum in this country.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we will definitely continue to follow this and see if it comes up in the debate about immigration. Ravi Ragbir is an organizer with the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City. He spent 2 years in detention. Catalina Nieto is a field director with the Detention Watch Network. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can watch that documentary if you want to put a face to this issue, Lost in Detention. It's online at Frontline's website. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us. What is the Obama administration's record on civil liberties? On the next Your Call, we'll explore the impacts of the National Security Agency's data collection program. Even before this program was exposed, civil liberties advocates called President Obama's record dismal. They say he has expanded the Bush administration's worst policies. So what explains this? How is the public responding? And what precedent does this set? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.